It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover this morning, starting with local and some good news for a change.
Yeah, we have at least a tentative deal to stop the gravel pit mine at Maury Island. That was announced this week. King County Executive Dow Constantine trying to swing a deal to purchase the land for a King County park from the company in Oregon who owns the land. They need to raise $36 million. The state legislature has put aside $15. They don't have all the money raised yet, so it's not a done deal, but it at least is an agreement in principle, and that is a very, very positive step forward for all the people in Seattle and especially on Vashon Island who have been fighting that proposed mine in a very environmentally sensitive area for a couple of years now. So congratulations to all those folks.
All right. So moving on, further developments this week in the John T. Williams shooting.
Yeah, it turns out this week that an anonymous person involved in the investigation of the shooting told the news media this week that the knife found with Williams' body was in a closed position. He had a folding knife that had a 3-inch blade that he used for wood carving. And when the shooting initially happened, police showed the knife to the media and said, look, he had this knife. He was carrying this knife with him and looked like he was threatening people with it. And that's the reason why Officer Burke shot him. However, it now turns out that the knife found on his body was in a closed position. And at least one witness told the PI that he didn't see a knife at all in Williams' hand when he was shot. And so now police are finally asking witnesses to the incident to come forward and speak to the police homicide unit, which I think is a hint that perhaps the Seattle Police Department may eventually file charges. The number for the police homicide unit is 206-684-5550 in case you were one of the many witnesses on that afternoon when Williams was shot in downtown Seattle.
Yeah, and just to be clear about this, what this means is that the officer got out of his car, pursued a person who we've already established was not looking at him and was not facing him because, you know, when he was shot, he was shot in the side. He was not shot moving forward, and who posed no threat and didn't even probably have the knife. If he had it in his hand, it was not open, and according to other witnesses, they didn't even see the knife in his hand. So, you know, why did the officer shoot this man? Why did he get out of his car and pursue him? We don't know at this point. Everything about the initial police story as to why this happened, which included the claim that Williams was lunging at the officer, has turned out to be a fiction. And we know absolutely nothing about why the shooting happened at this point. All we know is that if an individual had done this, if they had gotten out of their car in the middle of a busy intersection in broad daylight, pursued a person who was paying no attention to them and not posing any kind of a threat to anybody, and shot them, they would be facing murder charges right now.
All right. Moving on. Seattle will pay.
Yes. At least one state lawmaker has come forward and said that he would make sure Seattle will pay any cost overruns on the downtown traffic tunnel. Democrat Larry Sequist of the 26th District, which covers northern Tacoma and Gig Harbor, has said that since his constituents have had to pay tolls to pay for the second bridge over the Narrows Waterway in Tacoma, that he really believes that Seattle residents should have to pay if there are overruns on the tunnel. And if the issue comes up in this next legislative session, he has promised that he will introduce legislation, if necessary, to make sure that it is very clear that the overruns are going to be the responsibility of Seattle taxpayers, not of taxpayers throughout the state.
And a couple of things about that. Number one is that, of course, the major difference is that Gig Harbor residents wanted that second bridge over the Tacoma Narrows, whereas Seattle residents didn't really want the tunnel. And, you know, above and beyond that, that tells you that Christine Gregoire's pledge to veto any legislation from the legislature that would force Seattle to pay is really hollow because she's not going to be governor when such legislation would come up, unless she runs for a third term, which is widely not expected to happen. So that threat of that happening depends a lot on who's governor and who might potentially sign that legislation. And, you know, we're hearing nothing out of Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee, who are the two likely nominees for governor in 2012.
Yeah, and even then, you know, a veto isn't the final say necessarily if the legislature can bring together two-thirds of legislators to support sticking Seattle with the cost overruns, then they can override her veto.
And as we've seen from the Democrat from Gig Harbor pledging to do this, this is a, you know, sticking Seattle with the tab is a bipartisan issue.
It's a very popular issue. Yes.
Yeah.
Very popular stance,
I'd say. Moving on, Seattle City Council getting us one vote closer yesterday to pulling the plug on SCAN.
Yeah, we had a budget vote on King County on Seattle City Council yesterday, and while most of the attention and the media pointed toward the passing of an increase in the parking taxes, especially downtown, and that money going to the general fund, not going to transportation, so the people who are going to have to pay higher costs for driving in the city of Seattle, if they want to park the cars anyway, aren't being given any additional transportation choices to get out of their cars. That got a lot of attention, as it rightly should have, but what did not get a lot of attention is that the public access channel for SCAN TV, which broadcasts on, I believe, channel 77 and 29 on Broad Street and Comcast, they've announced they're going to pull the plug on December 31st this year as a result of the city council apparently not having the will to reinstate any of the funding. And there still is a chance that the full council could reinstate the funding in the budget. There is no city council person who has currently stepped forward saying they're willing to do that. So what SCAN TV supporters and public access supporters in general really need to do at this point is contact city council people and urge somebody to step forward and try and reinsert that money somewhere. Because particularly the idea that we're going to lose our cable access channel in Seattle, while the Seattle channel, which is supposedly our public channel, is not facing any serious funding cuts, and has really stopped programming a lot of its public interest programming. It's really more sort of lifestyle and fluff now, and you have to go online in order to find council hearings and that sort of thing. The public access is a really important outlet. It's an important outlet, as we've noted. You know, I'm not involved with Mike's show, Talking Stick TV, but that and Pirate TV are important local progressive shows. Democracy Now! Airs on it. A lot of immigrant programming airs on it. A lot of really vital stuff for the community that you simply can't get elsewhere on television. We're going to lose all that at the end of the year if the council doesn't change its mind. So give your city council people a call, email them, show up in their offices and bug them, and then film it and air it on public access before the end of the year.
Yeah, and write letters to the local newspaper, you know, contact the local TV stations, because it always irks me that whenever they cover this issue, they choose to talk about one program that will pick one program on the public access station, and it usually tends to be the program they think has the least value and that is, you know, the most sort of fluff.
Yeah, they'll talk about the psychics or the nudists or something and not talk about all the essential stuff.
They never
stuff
talk about
airs.
All the other stuff that is very important programming.
And if you're wondering where the money could potentially come from, again, the Seattle Channel, which gets millions of dollars of support, you know, mm-hmm. could easily take a hit to cover the
Yeah, it doesn't cost much
SCAN.
to cover the cost of SCAN.
No, their entire budget for SCAN is less than $1 million, about two-thirds of which comes from the city. So we're only talking about $650,000, $700,000 that comes from the city to support this. And, I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but in the context of the city budget, it's not.
Moving on, Nicholsville, developments there.
Yeah, good news and bad news. The good news is that the city and Nicholsville announced a deal this week in which Nicholsville will have a permanent home. The bad news is it won't be until March, and it won't be in a particularly accessible part of the city south of downtown. But the biggest part is that winter happens between now and March, and those folks still need a place to live. And their current U-District encampment is set to move. Their agreement runs through this weekend, so they're going to have to move again on Monday. They've not announced where they're going to move for this weekend, but it's unfortunate that the city could not find a home for them over the winter, when people who are living on the streets really need some kind of a permanent shelter, or really need to be indoors if at all possible. But the good news is that, unlike the previous administration, at least the McGinn City Hall is trying to do something about this and trying to set up for a permanent home. So that in at least long term is very good news. Short term, people still have to survive the winter.
All right. Moving on to national and the Department of Justice.
Yeah, the Department of Justice has been in charge of the investigation of the interrogation tapes, the CIA interrogation tapes that were destroyed about 5 years ago. The fact that they existed in the first place, and that they were destroyed because CIA employees and upper-level management were worried that they could be released and create a big scandal here in the U.S., the only reason we know about this is the ACLU had filed an Freedom of Information Act lawsuit seeking information on the Bush administration interrogation of terrorist detainees. And when it came out that these tapes existed but were not in the CIA's possession anymore because they had been ordered destroyed, then it was considered an enormous scandal. This came out in December of 2007. And when George Bush was still in office, and even at that time, the Bush administration realized, well, this is terrible, and we do have to start an investigation of this because this clearly was not an illegal act to destroy these tapes.
No, it was an illegal act.
No, it was not an illegal act to destroy the tapes. It was they contended it was a legal act to do the kinds of interrogation that were done, but it was not legal to destroy the tapes. They needed to they realized that those tapes should have been preserved, and so an investigation started into why the tapes were destroyed. Well, you know, the tapes were destroyed in 2005, and so 5 years has passed. The 5 year limit for filing charges has passed, and so the lead investigator, John H. Durham, the special prosecutor, he's finally come out and announced, well, because the deadline for filing charges has passed, I'm not going to file any charges. Which, no surprise, anyone who was a little bit suspicious that allowing the Department of Justice to investigate the CIA was not going to lead to any kind of charges, well, here's your proof. It clearly points to the fact that the Bush administration should have, or Congress should have, done something to set up a special investigator who was not at all linked to the U.S. government.
Yeah, and it was particularly amusing and kind of a sick kind of a way to have this happen the same week that the Obama administration, in the guise of Hillary Clinton, was in Cambodia lecturing the Cambodians on how they have an obligation to investigate the sordid and unfortunate parts of their national history. They, of course, were referring to the Pol Pot crimes, which are actually being investigated by the Cambodians. And at the same time, the Obama administration is trying to look the other way with much more recent crimes here in the U.S.
Yeah, and
the
Pol Pot era was, what, 25 years ago?
30.
30
yeah.
years ago. And we're talking about something that happened about 5 years ago.
Yep.
Or another potential comparison, dropping the ball on the CIA videotape investigation, but pursuing the activists in Minneapolis and Chicago.
Exactly.
Yes, there's your Department of Justice at work. All right, well, let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the New York Times reported that since May 6th, when the flash crash happened, many flash crashes, at least a dozen, have happened since then. For about a dozen different stocks, including the stocks of Citigroup, Washington Post Company, Core Molding, Nucor, Progress Energy, and about six others. What happens with the mini flash crashes is the price of a stock suddenly goes from, say, $48 down to $4 within a matter of seconds, and may go as low as a penny, which happened in the case of Nucor, before it triggers the exchange on which the stock is being traded. It triggers the circuit breaker for the exchange. Trading is halted in that stock for about 5 minutes, and then when trading resumes, the price goes back up to around $48, what it was originally. Now, folks might remember the flash crash back on May 6th. What happened was whole segments of the market plunged to near zero. Stocks from IBM to Microsoft suddenly lost nearly all of their value. Some stocks, which no one had ever heard of, shot up to, you know, nearly $1,000 a share. This made people lose all confidence in the stock market at that time. And a number of investors have, and particularly small investors, have said, what am I putting my savings into, you know, here if it can suddenly be wiped out in a matter of seconds? And a lot of people have withdrawn their money from the market. Now, it turns out that the flash crash of May 6th is not an isolated incident. It's been happening regularly since then, only just in single shares here and there. The folks who instituted the idea of the market circuit breakers are saying that, well, look, the market circuit breakers that we've instituted are doing their job, you know. On the other hand, other folks, critics of the way the market functions right now, say that, well, the fact that it's still going on just in single shares is an indication that it could happen over the broad market again, much sooner than we think.
Why does the circuit breakers remind me of the guys that tweak the machines in the casinos?
Because it's very much like that.
It's very similar. And remember, the house always wins.
Yes, yes. Well, what's interesting, too, is people, it's very clear that what is causing these flash crashes are a combination of electronic trading, the fact that you can make these trades in microseconds and there's nobody overseeing the whole thing, the existence of high-frequency traders who make a profit from the pennies or fractions of pennies that they get by instituting millions of trades throughout a day, you know, executed in microseconds. So they buy a stock and sell it almost immediately and make a few pennies on, or a fraction of a penny per trade. And they enter the market every morning with their money and leave it at the end of the day with all of their money. So they own no stocks at the beginning of the day and they own no stocks at the end of the day. They're clearly just guys who game the market. And the existence of computer algorithms, which make this automatic buy and sell happen, and the fact that a lot of these algorithms are set up to be open-ended so that there's no human to stop them when prices fall below certain levels. Those are the things that are really the big problems that cause these flash crashes. And those are the kinds of things that need to be addressed by the SEC, and they just haven't done it.
And just as you hear all this, ask yourself, is this any way to run an economy?
Yeah. And, you know, it's just another reason why the Fed's policy of bringing down long-term rates to raise stock prices is not going to lead to people spending money anytime soon, because so many Americans have gotten out of the market for these reasons.
As well they should.
Well, at least we don't have software and computers running our electoral system.
Yet.
Oh, wait.
Or in maybe not in a coordinated way. Uh-huh. Yet.
All right. Other economic news?
Yeah, this week the business press was dominated with headlines about the G20 meeting in Seoul, South Korea, and the fact that the U.S. right after the U.S. Fed announced that they were going to buy $600 to $900 billion of long-term treasuries to bring down long-term interest rates in the U.S., essentially printing money that would then weaken the dollar and increase currency problems in the rest of the world. Timothy Geithner went to the G20 and he wanted to talk about trade imbalances. He shook his finger at China and said, you need to let your currency value rise so that your population can take over from our population and become the leading consumers in the world. And China and the rest of the world just looked at him and shook their heads and said, what are you talking about? Your government just allowed your currency to, your government is engaged in currency manipulation right now by printing money and weakening the dollar. Who are we to listen to you?
And China in particular is looking at them and saying, remind me again, who owes who how much money?
Yes, yes. Who owns your debt again? Isn't it us? So
well, I got that right, didn't I?
It just really points out the arrogance of U.S. politicians, of politicians in this country, that we're so totally blind to how we're perceived by the rest of the world, and we just believe that the only interests that matter are American interests, and that no one else has their own national interests to think about
or should be pursuing them.
Yeah. Right. Or that that we can set rules for the rest of the world that we don't have to follow.
Yeah. Kind of like investigating our past.
All right. Anything else on economic news?
Nope.
Okay. A new study out about Arizona?
Yeah. A Mexican group published a study this week looking at the Latino population in Arizona and saying that some 100,000 Latinos have fled Arizona, and no breakdown as to how many of those had proper documentation to be there versus people who were there from Mexico. But some 100,000 Latinos have left Arizona over the last year since the same time in 2009. Now, there's also no indication how much of that was as a result of the debate over SB 1070, the harsh new anti-immigrant law that also encourages, in fact, requires that police engage in racial profiling against all Latinos, and how much of it was due to the economy. We'll find out next summer when farmers in Arizona need farm workers in order to pick the crops, and they might or might not be available. But
or the tourism industry in Arizona suffers because there aren't people to clean hotel rooms and
and a fair amount of the tourist industry in Arizona comes from Mexico as well. So
yeah,
you know, tourism from Mexico can also drop down.
Yeah.
So we'll see where that goes, but initial indications at least are that Arizona is going to take it on the chin in their economy because of their racist law.
All right. And developments this week with Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah, the United States Supreme Court upheld a lower court's refusal to issue an injunction on the Pentagon's enforcement of Don't Ask, Don't Tell while waiting for a federal appeals court to decide on the appeals of several lower court rulings saying that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is unconstitutional. Now, this has put the Obama administration in the rather awkward position advocating for the continuance of Don't Ask, Don't Tell when it's on record as claiming that it wants to abolish the policy. The Obama administration, of course, could finish all of this very quickly simply by issuing an order abolishing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But they're claiming anyway that they're waiting for the Pentagon to finish studying the issue, as though for some reason, you know, studying as to whether to end discrimination or not is going to come up with any other possible conclusion than saying that discrimination is a bad thing.
Right.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, in Afghanistan, well, actually outside of Afghanistan, here in the United States, it turns out that the U.S. military dictatorship has announced, in spite of the civilian puppet government's announcement that troops would be coming home in mid-2011, the military dictatorship has said, no, we're going to be at war in Afghanistan until the year 2014.
At least.
And so it's very interesting for me to see, you know, here's the Obama administration, the civilian side of the U.S. government saying, no, we are starting the drawdown in July 2011. And at the same time, and in the same week, even the same day, when Admiral Mike Mullen, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates, and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton all have agreed and all have said that, no, we are not going to leave Afghanistan until 2014. It really makes you wonder who is in control.
Apparently not the commander-in-chief, quote-unquote.
Yeah, whatever the term commander-in-chief means these days.
All right. Moving on to Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq, let's see here. My notes are a little bit scattered here. Oh, yeah. In Iraq, the government announced that they had come to a deal, that they had formed a coalition to include the Sunni group Iraqiya, led by Ayed Alawi, the group that actually won the elections. Well, they started by convening parliament and appointing a new president and then appointing a speaker of parliament. And then the Sunnis, it appears, had been promised that they would get a few concessions from parliament in order to join the alliance. And when those concessions were brought up in parliament right after the speaker had been appointed, the Shiites promptly voted them down and said, let's table these and get on with appointing a new prime minister. And the Sunni coalition, all the members stood up and said, well, guess we're not part of this government anymore. And they walked out, which means that
there's once again no government.
That the Iraqi government formed and promptly disbanded.
All right. Moving on to developments this week in Burma.
Yeah, a farce of an election held last Sunday in Burma, which, as widely expected, reelected the military junta that controlled the election and basically did not allow any significant opposition to appear on the ballot. Meanwhile, the house arrest sentence of Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi is set to expire today. Now, the military had said it was going to release her yesterday, one day short of the expiration of her term, but apparently attached conditions to that release, including her inability to engage in any form of politics or to travel to certain parts of the country to meet people. And she's refusing to leave her house until those conditions are dropped and she's released unconditionally. So there's something of a standoff going on in Burma right now between Aung San and the military junta. Their military dictatorship. So we'll see how that plays out. But there's a potential, again, for a lot of street unrest in support of her in Burma right now. So that's something to keep an eye on.
All right. And developments in Haiti.
Yeah, a nasty, nasty cholera epidemic happening in Haiti right now. Over 800 people already dead. Some 11,000 have apparently come down with the illness, and that number expected to increase sharply in the next few days. Cholera, of course, due to contaminated water supply, and this really underscores a couple of things. Number one, how inadequate the response has been to rebuilding infrastructure in the wake of last January's earthquake. That water treatment is still a very, very serious concern, and lack of sanitation in Port-au-Prince and elsewhere in Haiti, a very serious concern that you can have this kind of epidemic. And also that, once the initial shock of the earthquake has worn off, coverage of the cholera epidemic and coverage in general of the inadequate international response and inability of the local government and international aid foundations to try and rebuild Haiti has really been missing from U.S. media coverage. We simply don't pay attention to things that are happening in other parts of the world if they're not immediate and graphic.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about real victims of the economic downturn, one of the reasons governments haven't ponied up the money to help out Haiti is because they're busy trying to balance their budgets and trying to deal with the problems of the economic downturn. So we know who the winners are. The winners are rich folks, shareholders, big corporations that made a mint off of things when times were good and got government bailouts when times were bad in the last couple of years.
And have been responsible for a lot of the economic downturn.
Yeah, and the losers are people like the entire population of Haiti, which cannot get any kind of aid to help them out in their time of need.
All right. And finally, briefly, Israel.
Yeah, Israel announcing 1,000 new housed units in East Jerusalem, which, it's a nice deal. The rest of the world thinks East Jerusalem is contested and belongs to the Palestinians. The Israelis have announced, no, it's not even part of the contested territory. It's ours, and therefore we can do with it what we want, and it's really none of the international community's concern. It's like saying, I've decided that I own Bothell, and I'm going to tear down all the housing there and put up a new subdivision. And I don't see what the controversy could be because I own Bothell. So what's the problem? It's kind of like that. And so that came on the eve of Netanyahu visiting the United States, where he has met primarily with Republican leaders and not with the Democratic administration, which is very, very interesting also.
All right. And events?
Yeah, three of them to talk about. One going on today where Jess Sundin, one of the victims of the FBI raids in Minneapolis and in Chicago, is in town. She was in Seattle last night. Today she'll be down south. She'll be speaking at 5 p.m. at an event at Evergreen State College, Lecture Hall 1 in Olympia, and then at Coffee Strong, their second anniversary party from 7 o'clock on tonight at 15109 Union Avenue Southwest at the north entrance of Fort Lewis in Lakewood. So that's Jess Sundin tonight in Olympia and Lakeview. Also today, there will be celebrate Armistice Day with Veterans for Peace. That going on between 7 and 9 o'clock tonight at Bethany United Church of Christ on Beacon Hill at 6220 Beacon Avenue.
6230 Beacon Avenue South.
I'm sorry, yeah, on Beacon Hill. And then tomorrow, Physicians for Social Responsibility will be having their annual dinner with Reverend Rich Lang being the keynote speaker. That'll be 4:30 p.m. at the Center for Urban Horticulture on the east side of the UW campus in Seattle.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is online at www.eatthestate.org with news and opinion and humor and a blog and a calendar of events and all kinds of good stuff. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org.